This is the Wimpheimer Guggenheim International Lecture, International Employment Opportunities for Registered Dietitians. This program was really in response to a lot of discussion and participation last year when we talked about some of the opportunities. And so today we have three excellent speakers that will talk about some of the opportunities that are available and we'll have each speaker come up, and then we'll have a panel and keep the questions and answers till the end. This session was really organized to talk about opportunities for international development work for dietitians and nutritionists with a wide range of opportunities in both the public and private sector. I also want to acknowledge Alice Wimpheimer, who established this lectureship to increase international collaborations and educate all of us to help each other and also to have an impact on the countries around the world to improve health and nutrition. So our first speaker this morning, I'm happy to introduce Helena Pichon. And she is the founder and director of the Nutrition Quality Lab in Cali, Colombia. She created the lab, found the funding, and equipped the state-of-the-art facility. And she also has worked with looking at nutrient bioavailability, nutrient determinations, functional foods, and other quality aspects. In looking at her resume, she has contributed so much to the Latin American community in many different countries. She's also project coordinator for AgroSalud, which is combating hidden hunger in Latin America. Her background is also she has a MPH in international health from Harvard, and her other three degrees were from Cornell University in international nutrition and biology. She has worked with the with PAHO, the Pan American Health Organization, in Latin and Central America, and she is fluent in both English and Spanish. She's written over 50 publications. And what impressed me, she has mentored 19 students from around the world, and so she in her lab and in other positions. So I want to welcome her as our first speaker this morning.
Good morning to everyone, and thank you for that kind presentation. In particular, I'd like to thank Diane Moore and Caitlin Peters from the American Dietetic Association for the invitation to form a part of this panel. And as mentioned, I will be talking about opportunities for international nutrition work. By way of disclosure, I'm currently a consultant to the Pan American Health Organization. I work at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture in Colombia, South America. I currently have research projects supported by the Harvest Plus Project, the Colombian government, and the OPEC Fund for International Development. I'd also like to mention that I'm a member of the American Society for Nutrition, which is mainly focused on those who do research in nutrition. If anyone is interested about hearing about that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. So this morning, I hope you will learn about international nutrition job opportunities through this presentation and get tips on how to get started or how to re-engage in an international career if it's something you haven't thought about in a while. This is a slide showing my nonlinear path to international work, sort of what I've done in the past 20 years to bring me to where I am today. And I'll be showing you this through a series of pictures, which was a really fun way to put this presentation together. I highlighted in red Spanish language because as I shared this presentation with different colleagues, they said that was so key that you speak a second language in order to do international work that I wanted to start highlighting that from the beginning. And all of the little red asterisks in this diagram indicate where having spoken Spanish was absolutely crucial to my being able to complete the tasks. So as you can see, most of the work that I've done where I've needed to speak Spanish. So the reason I speak Spanish is because my parents are from Colombia, and so we've always spoken Spanish at home. I was able to solidify that training through a study abroad program at the University of Seville in Spain. And in terms of the nutrition area, how I got that training was through my bachelor's and master's training at Cornell. And you can see that in neither thesis project did I focus on an issue specifically related to international nutrition. Nevertheless, for my master's thesis, I did work with Hispanic women. And later on, I'll talk about how you may be able to use some opportunities in the U.S. working with minority groups to bridge opportunities to work overseas. So how did I get my first overseas job? I was taking a vacation through Central America with a group. We did a bike trip through Honduras and El Salvador, and a couple that was on that trip were going to be going to Nicaragua after the trip to meet with their former boss from an NGO. And I said I was looking for work. Could they mention my name to their former boss? And they did, and he called me, and we talked. And I was offered a position at World Relief Nicaragua. At this point, I had my bachelor's and master's in nutrition, and I was hired as a translator because they really needed someone to help translate their technical documents from Spanish to English, which was not really of tremendous interest to me, but I saw it as an opportunity, and I was able to use it well, because this project that I got involved in were... When I just started, they were starting their baseline survey, so I was able to integrate nutrition questions into the baseline survey. I was the person who had the most analytical skills, so I ended up doing the data entry, data analysis, final report writing. So I really was able to do nutrition, even though they hired me to do translation. Then, the way I got my second overseas job, I always love to share this story with people. I saw in the newspaper in Nicaragua that the CRS was looking for a technical advisor. I read the job description, felt I was underqualified, and didn't apply. In the meantime, I was interacting with headquarters staff from World Relief with whom I was working, and I told them, you know, my contract's going to be up in a year. Can you keep me in mind for any job opportunities? They circulated my resume with their colleagues in the Washington area, and I got a phone call from CRS asking if I would apply for the job that I felt I was underqualified for. So I interviewed and I got the job, and that's just a lesson for us all that we should apply for any job we're remotely interested in, remotely qualified for, and let others make a determination if we are the best candidates or not. In this job with CRS, the time that I was with them, we were in a training of trainers phase. So you can see in these photographs, we were trying to present health information in a very visual and entertaining way, since we were going to be working with populations with low literacy and numeracy skills. A few months later, I got a phone call from Emory University. They had gotten my name through some professors that I had worked with in the States, and they asked if I'd be interested in coordinating a project, an international nutrition project, focused on infant and young child feeding. And it was I was going to be going back to the States, so that was a little bit different from what I was currently doing, but I would continue to have international projects, which was interesting to me. So in this project, here we have the logo of this project, the symbol of this project. It's focused on infant and young child feeding. We had activities in Mexico as well as in Peru. And then my boss got another project looking at infant and young child nutrition in Vietnam, so I had the opportunity to work on that project. And so in a span of 3 years, I was involved in these two infant and young child nutrition projects, and I got to travel overseas extensively. The project that I initially went to work with at Emory is... we developed a how-to manual in the area of infant and young child nutrition for program planners, and it's a manual that's promoted by the Pan American Health Organization. So through them, I was invited to train individuals in its use in these five different countries. So again, I was able to leverage an experience that I started 10 years ago, and 10 years later, it's still giving me dividends through consultancies that people call me to help in training. Through the contacts that I made in Peru, I was able to go back to Peru to do my field work for my PhD, again, looking at infant nutrition. And then when I finished, I needed to think about what I was going to do when I grew up. So a job opportunity came up in Colombia, and I really wasn't very interested because I wanted to be based in the U.S., but I figured I'd apply because in the worst case scenario, if I got an interview, I would get a free trip to Colombia and I could visit my family. So I went to Colombia and absolutely loved it, loved the setting, loved my boss, what the project was going to be about, an opportunity to create a nutrition research line in an agricultural research organization was very exciting to me. So I ended up taking the position. I've been there 5 years now. And essentially what I do is conduct nutrition research at the intersection with food science. Those of you who may have heard of researching linkages between agriculture and nutrition, that's basically what I do. As Judy mentioned, certainly raising funding for that research is an important part of what I do. Supervise students completing theses or internships. We've had now it's up to about 25 students from 6 different countries, I believe, who've done work with us. And I also manage different staff. The work that I do in Colombia has been personally satisfying. I invite you to look at this YouTube video of work that we've done in southern Colombia in an indigenous population trying to improve school-age children's nutrition. We've also done work which has national relevance, and this is especially satisfying. This project that we worked on was to gather foods consumed by minority groups in the Amazon and to do the full nutritional analysis so that these foods get integrated in the Colombian food composition table. And this is really important because if it's not in the food composition table, the government programs cannot recommend foods. So we have portions of the population in Colombia who don't eat foods that are in the food composition table, so their indigenous foods cannot be promoted unless we get their data into the table. So we're really happy to be a part of this process. For the next part of my presentation, I wanted to focus on giving you some ideas of what you should be thinking about if you want to have an international career. And so what I did was generate some initial slides and sent them out to friends and colleagues and asked them for comments. And I got feedback from all of these individuals. So really from this part forward, what I'm going to be talking about is a compilation of their ideas and my ideas. So why might you be interested in having and working overseas initially? From a professional point of view, it's really important that you not look at this as an opportunity for you to provide the solution to a problem in another country. It's not for you to impose your models on another group of individuals. It's really about learning jointly with your colleagues in that setting, to collaborate with them, to contribute to the development of individuals, communities, and countries. And so it's absolutely important that we act ethically, considering the feasibility and sustainability of our work, because it's more than likely that we're going to pull out in a few years, but our colleagues there will remain addressing the issues that are important for their country. From a personal standpoint, why might you be interested in going overseas? You learn so much by being outside of your comfort zone. It's a lot of fun to meet new people and maybe try new cuisine, see different parts of the world. The travel is wonderful. I've visited about 20 to 25 countries on my company's dime. And there's certainly challenges of working overseas, which if you like that, it can be great. What role might you play if you were to work overseas? You might be more of an academic doing research, sort of what I do. You may be a supervisor, implementer of programming, of programs going on. You could be in a donor position, a volunteer, a food industry representative, which we'll hear more about later, a policy wonk, a government official, an NGO employee, a missionary, an advocate, a UN representative, an international bank worker, and I'm sure there are other roles that you could also play. So just to give you an idea, you can do a lot of things overseas and in a capacity as a nutritionist or dietitian. You will most likely be working with people from other disciplines. You probably won't be able to work it sort of silo, so it'll be really important that you be a people person and be able to work well with others. You will likely travel both within the country and among countries in your region, so you'd have to be ready for that. And in talking with different colleagues, they said that it's more likely you're going to face more public health issues than be able to work in clinical nutrition or dietetics directly, just because of the nature of work in other countries, especially in developing countries. It's much more integrative. They don't look at nutrition in silos. Where exactly will you work? Will you be based in the U.S. or will you be overseas? if you're going to be overseas, all of the rest of these bullets really apply to you. Do you need to get a work visa to work in that country? If you have a higher level position, your company or the organization you work with will take care of getting the work visa for you. However, if it's an entry level position, they probably won't, and you'd be left to your own devices to get that. I mentioned early on that speaking a second language is so important to being able to work overseas. Obviously, if you speak French, that opens Western Africa for you, Spanish and Portuguese for Latin America. Will you require licensing? To be a dietitian in Colombia, where I live, yes, you do need a license. How long will you be there? That will impact on so many other things that you need to think about. Will there be job opportunities for your spouse? And if you're in a gay relationship, does that country recognize gay marriages? And will your spouse be able to live with you? And in what kind of legal status? What schooling do you want for your children, and will it be available where you want to go? Will you be able to take your pets easily, and will they be able to roam as they do at home? If you have a home currently in North America, how can you handle, will you be able to handle managing a home in a second place as well? The hobbies that you really enjoy doing, will you be able to do them in the new country where you'll be based? Security is really important. How safe will you feel in your day-to-day job, and how safe will you and your family members feel living in this country? Climate. Can you handle the coldness of Mongolia or the hot, humidity of the tropics? What is your preference there? If there's a pre-existing medical condition in your family, are the health services available that you will need? And in the absence of those, can you get access to good quality care when you need it? How accepting is the host country of foreigners? For example, if you profess a religion that's different from the majority, will you feel comfortable? Will they be accepting of you? Does your organization offer home leave? Will it pay for you and your family to travel back to North America once every year or once every 2 years? If not, will they at least give you the time off to do that? What's the communication situation? High-speed internet, satellite phones, even just cable television. Does it exist? Will you be able to be in touch with your family and friends back home? There are challenges and charms about living in urban settings and rural settings. Where do you want to be based? And finally, for your job, even just getting to work on a daily basis, there'll probably be different ways to get to work and then to travel within the country and within the region. Will you be comfortable in terms of having to travel on in a rickshaw or other types of settings that you may have to travel on? Managing expectations. What will you do if you don't get placed in your country or region of the world? In other words, if it's not your first choice, can you handle that? Know that there's a lot of bureaucracy and corruption, especially in developing countries, and that you need to act with integrity, both personally and institutionally, to be able to handle that. Expect for everything to take longer than you planned and longer than it would if you were based here in the U.S. How good are you at handling that kind of disappointment? Expect delays. You're probably not going to be able to meet all of your objectives. Does your personality and does your boss allow you to handle that? So now, how you might get started. Here are some ideas on getting some short-term experiences, just to give you an idea if this is really what you think you might want to do for a part of your career. You might go as a volunteer to another country through your church, through an NGO such as those that sponsor children. They often organize annual trips for sponsors to go meet the children that they're sponsoring. Idealist.org lists thousands of jobs and volunteer opportunities overseas, so you might want to check out their website. Different international conferences, for example, Micronutrient Forum, International Congress of Nutrition, they organize study tours. So you spend an extra day or two and you be able to go see, for example, plants where they fortify wheat flour with micronutrients. Sort of what they did here at ADA of allowing, yesterday you could go to the zoo, San Diego Zoo, to talk with animal nutritionists. So something similar to that, but in another country. Rotary Youth Exchange Program is also a short-term opportunity to be able to go overseas. I believe that's limited to high school and college students. You might check out embassies and consulates in your state to see what scholarly and cultural exchange programs they offer for people. If you decide to study a language in another country, what a wonderful opportunity to then go and talk with nutritionists and dietitians there and see how it is that they do their work there. And maybe you could even volunteer with them. For those of you who have specialized training, such as nurses, emergency medical technicians, you might be able to get to be able to volunteer to go to emergency settings, like in March with the earthquake and tsunami in Japan. You know, groups of people that went as volunteers to aid in that. Check out job fairs, especially of organizations that very specifically have an international affiliate, for example, such as the Global Health Council, which meets in Washington, D.C. every May and June, the American Public Health Association, they meet in November. Take advantage of those job fairs and the people who attend those meetings to get to know what they do. And for students, use your thesis as an opportunity to be able to go overseas. Actively seek internships that would take you overseas. Consider participating in the study abroad program, or taking short courses that would, again, get you overseas. As an example, I'd like to highlight the Community Dietetics Internship Rotation in rural Ghana, which Iowa State University will be initiating starting next year. Jean Anderson and Aaron Bergquist, who are here in the first row, they are representatives of Iowa State University and can answer any questions that you might have about this program. And I also have some flyers, which I'd be happy to give to anyone who wants more information. So in terms of some longer-term experiences, everything on the left-hand side are established programs. If you get into those, they will likely they will give you some sort of a salary. They'll pay for your trip overseas and give you operating expenses. Everything on the right-hand side is stuff that you would kind of have to do on your own, such as look at English language private schools in developing countries. They're always looking for native English speakers, so you might go as a teacher. Down here, private voluntary organizations or NGOs, the really big ones, the international ones, the CRSs, the CARES, check out their website and see what kind of jobs you can get with them, because they always have projects going on overseas. If your budget can swing it, take on unpaid internships. The UN agencies allow these. And you might consider low-paying or not-so-relevant jobs. And here I go back to my personal experience. My first job in Nicaragua was to be a translator, and I was paid $300 a month. 6 months later at CRS, I was paid $1,300 a month. And a year later at Emory, I was getting $3,000 a month. So in a span of 12 months, I was able to increase by tenfold my salary, gain some really relevant experience that was able to bring me to where I am today in my career. And this is something that I touched on earlier, that you can leverage your domestic experiences in order to bridge into international opportunities. If you can show international organizations, you know, for example, how to work in a multicultural setting because you currently work with migrant farm workers or with immigrant communities. And in the previous slide, the opportunities that I mentioned on the right-hand slide, you may have to find funding to make those happen. And here's just one example of an organization that lists opportunities for scholarships and fellowships and so on. So in closing, there are lots of international nutrition opportunities out there and ways to get them paid for. So it's really super important for you to be proactive, to find the opportunity that best suits what you're looking for at the present time. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pichon, especially for all that informative advice, and we will have questions later. I see there's a lot of interest, certainly in international work and international studies. And I always give advice about take those opportunities to students, even if you don't feel qualified for the job. It is now my pleasure to welcome Dr. Jenny Taylor Bond, who's Professor Emerita of Michigan State University in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition. She was also Assistant Dean of International Students and Programs and Acting Director of Women in International Development. She was also on the board of Christian Children's Fund for 8 years and the Child Fund International for 8 years. In 2005, she gave the Cooper Lecture, When the Whole World is Your Family. When the Whole World is Your Family. And so we're very honored to have you come and give words of wisdom from your experience and some of your opportunities. Thank you.
Okay. I come from a very different perspective. My doctoral research was renal function in the obese Mendel rat. And so my path was as circuitous as the previous speaker, but I think I have learned some things that I can share with all of you. I was aware of some of the things that Helena was going to say, so I'm trying to build on those. I may repeat a few things. But I really appreciate the support that Alice Wimpheimer has provided through the years to increase the visibility of international activities in the American Dietetic Association. It is amazing, and you will see some of the results in my presentation. She has single-handedly, almost, pushed international in this organization. So it is a real honor to participate in a lecture that she has supported. Whoops, are we? I'm sorry? Oh, okay. So that means I can talk more. What I want to tell you is, obviously, I come from a different perspective. I come out of the university, have never had a full-time international position. But hopefully some of the things that I will say today will help those of you who, for a variety of reasons, cannot dedicate their professional or their personal lives to international work, but still can do really good things. So I hope that there will be at least a couple of things everybody in the audience can do today, regardless of your age or if you worked on kidney function in the obese Mendel rat. Okay, and I did request that I could use this format. So that you have had international opportunities for dietetic professionals. This picture happens to be one of a famine area in Kenya where I worked as in helping assess the nutritional status. This was probably in 2004 or 5, and I will tell you they're back in famine again today. Retiree, I think all of those things. At the present time, I have no research funding, no consultantships. I am, quote, retired, although it took me 3 times to get there. But I do have a passion for improving the lives of people across the globe, especially children and women, and under the conditions that Helena shared with you, not to go in with solutions, my way to do it, but work with others, and ultimately develop the capacity of those with whom we work. So I want to provide opportunities for greater participation in international activities, to provide some resources to use in selecting those, be they volunteer or paid, and to share examples of international experiences of dietetic and nutrition professionals. I also want to emphasize that the benefits of sharing our commitment and expertise globally is priceless and rewarding. My target audience today, and I hope you're here, dietetic students and interns, RDs, CDEs, and others with advanced training, DTRs, retired dietetic professionals, paid and volunteer professionals, and that's the audience. The approach would be paid and volunteer positions and short and long-term positions. How can students prepare? And many of these things Helena has mentioned, but I will emphasize again. And the first one is foreign language. It's amazing. I do not speak a foreign language. I did do an intensive course in Spanish, an immersion course in Spanish on an elder hostel trip in Mexico, but that is not one of the things, language is not one of the things that I have to bring to the table. However, I've had lots of opportunities to work with others who do and have worked around it. Courses in development, sociology, anthropology, women's studies, study abroad or a spring break work trip, volunteer with a professional, with a professor doing international research, or if you have an international unit on your campus, as we do at Michigan State with international studies and programs, try to get into that unit. A number of our student assistants in ISP when I was there really wanted to go into an international position, and that was one of the routes that they could take. They were like a sponge absorbing the information. Work or befriend or live with international students. Seek out schools with a track record of international nutrition research and programs. Helena mentioned several, certainly Cornell, Johns Hopkins, UC Davis, and others. And for Michigan State, Africa. We have tremendous programs in Africa over many, many years. Contact authors of research articles that interest you. Those persons doing research in international research, particularly, for example, I think if you're interested in breastfeeding, work out of UC Davis. Do his work out of UC Davis. Apply for the Mickey Leland International Fellow Program. Investigate the Brain Award. That one specifically is for language and other courses to help you. Now, faculty, and I hope there's some faculty here too, or you're going to be faculty in the future, encourage students to learn another language, to think outside of the box, take courses outside of their major, and consider a study abroad. Encourage participation in clubs, seminars, and activities related to global issues, especially those related to health. That's a little easier if you have a medical school on your campus. We actually have 3, human med, osteopathic, and veterinary medicine, so we have an abundance of these seminars. But I've looked even at some of the liberal arts schools, smaller schools, and they're there as well. Support student-organized efforts to offer assistance to those in need internationally. A group of our medical students organized to collect shoes, for example, to send to some countries. And know the international programs and support systems on your campus. That would apply for faculty and students. Become aware of interventions that have been tried and their impact. Here we have photographs from 4 African countries in which I worked. As you look at some of these interventions, and you're probably going to pick them up primarily on websites of the NGOs or in research, look at who provided them, where are they, what can you learn from these that will then make you a better applicant for some of these positions. I found particularly interesting the worksheet for international experience, and this does follow Helena's presentation well. It's adapted from Heckscher, and she asks, this is from How to Live Your Dream of Volunteering Overseas. In what field do I want to work or volunteer? In what geographic area? Obviously, if you have language, that would determine where you might want to go. For what type of organization? An NGO, a government entity, perhaps industry? Timeline, how long can I afford to go on a budget? Do I have to be paid, or can I contribute something myself? What skills do I already have? And don't underestimate those. What skills do I need or want to develop? And this one is, if you're thinking about international, this is a really good one to ask yourself, particularly if you are an undergraduate considering graduate school. What will be my initial approach? How will I start? In fact, one of the things that she suggests is just go to a place and try to find a job, sort of like the bike trip. What will be my initial approach? How will I start? Who can be a practical and encouraging ally as I seek to find an experience? And this is a really, really important one. Find a mentor. Find someone who has had similar experiences that you want, in which you want to participate, but someone who can be brutally honest with you too and say, I don't think that's possible at your time in life or whatever else that may be, but you need that very objective evaluation. And finally, what are my next steps? Now, if you go on the web and Google international opportunities, you will find many, many listings. There are many organizations out there, many groups providing these. I've listed some of these here, and the Global Health Fellows Program, the Global Service Corps. This one is particularly good because it focuses, it has suggestions for and opportunities for students, for mid-career individuals. Those happen to be in Cambodia, Tanzania, and Thailand, and happen to be for 2 to 6 weeks long, but also positions for active retirees and boomers, or you can actually design a group experience. The other one that I would suggest is the International Volunteer Programs Association. That has information on positions, fellowships, scholarships, funding, publications, etc. Some of those I've listed here may apply more if you are already trained or you've had experience, for example, the DevEx.com. But huge, look at the numbers there, 500,000 development professionals and 1,000 donors and organizations, an attempt to match people. There are many faith-based opportunities. I've just listed some of them. This is a very long list. The opportunities vary from different organizations, different ones. What I would suggest is that you look at, start with your own organization, one from your own faith, or consider, there are many local NGOs as well, particularly in some of our larger cities, and I'll give you an example of one of those in a few minutes. Additional activities. Participate in a service club with international projects and support. And the one I've listed is Rotary, and I am a Rotarian. I am a Rotarian because I believe in the projects that they are supporting in terms of internationally that link very well with what I think important areas now. Rotaract is an organization at the college level, and those of you who are in school now, check and see if there's a Rotaract group in your university or if there's a local Rotary club that's willing to start one. The group study exchange, that is a particularly important program that is 25 to 40 years of age and 4 weeks that any of you could apply for, and there are others as well. Do you have a sister city organization in your city? We have three in Lansing, and they work internationally, and I can have the opportunity to work with them. Or consider applying for a Fulbright Fellowship. That can be for undergrads as well as faculty members and even retirees. They have a shorter program. Or take an elder hostel. Become aware of problems in the area. Again, this is inform yourself early on. Opportunities, we've talked about some of these. Go on a study or work tour with Heifer International, Catholic Relief Services, Sister City, Habitat for Humanity has international opportunities. Make yourself so that you are really become more a citizen of the world. What countries are now insecure due to drought, conflicts, that will help you know where you might want to go. Particularly become aware of world food programs and support efforts to improve conditions of communities at risk using the guidelines that Helena presented. The other thing that I can tell you is that dollars are always acceptable, but be diligent. Contributions, if you can't do anything else, contribute to those organizations that are doing things that you really embrace, think are important. But be very careful in doing this and check with Charity Navigator or some of the other organizations that evaluate these groups. Travel, observe outside of the tourist spots, participate in local internationally focused activities, work with refugees in your area, and there's certainly no lack of, we have an abundance of those in our Lansing area. Participate in international related activities, or if they're not there, initiate them. Be an entrepreneur, initiate them. Two men in our area, for example, have started orphanages, one in Mexico that is quite successful, and one in his homeland of Uganda. Go beyond the tourist areas. We need this to recognize where individuals are. These happen to be pictures from Thailand, Mexico, India, and Ghana. One of the things I'd suggest you do is review the activities of the Wimpheimer Guggenheim essay winners. Now, Alice has supported this essay for 19 years. I told you, she was like the mother of international approaches within the organization. I've just chosen five. The initiation of the training program for pediatric oncology dietitians, that was out of St. Jude's. The solar cooking project with in El Salvador. That was a registered dietitian who did that. Another individual co-founded an NGO. That's what I was saying. I don't think everybody needs to start an NGO. I think you want to be sure that we don't have just lots of small ones doing small things, but if there isn't, if you see a void and you have the dollars, consider it. She's now focusing on AIDS orphans in Zimbabwe. The cross-cultural exchange came out of Texas Women's University, but other RDs who received this essay award, look at the list of projects there of areas, India, Syria, etc., basically all throughout the world. Incorporate international activities in your current position. Now, I was really, it was really a good thing that I could do this, and others, one I wanted to pick out in particular is Lorraine Weatherspoon, who is in the audience. Lorraine is working with groups in Botswana and Tanzania to improve nutritional status of children with HIV/AIDS. We have two other members in our department who started a study abroad in Tanzania. This is a really good one, and Sandy Parker is in the audience right now. Sandy, where are you? Are you still here? Would you just stand up a minute? No, do, because I want them to see you. If they have questions afterwards, I want to be able to find you, them to find you. Betty and Sandy spent 4 weeks in the Marshall Islands, and this is published in Diabetes Care and Education. They went on with a local NGO, this is local to the Grand Rapids area, a four-week mission trip to assess medical care and diabetes self-management. And I'm quoting Sandy when she says, and this is what I hope you will take home with you, there's so much more that we can do besides individual counseling and teaching classes. We can actually go in as experts and help healthcare providers and governments improve the situation with diabetes. I thought that it was, if you dig deep in this article, what the recipients of this is fascinating why Marshall Islands is included there, but I don't want to spend time on that right now. But what the recipient stated is, they said we were different from any other group that had come in to them because we asked them what they needed, what were their concerns. We did not come in with a prescribed solution. And that is very, very important. For some of you who are thinking, I don't know if I have any in the military today, but these are examples of two RDs in the military who have made contributions through their own work. And this, if you do have a military background or you have students who are interested in this, this is a good background for some paid and volunteer international experiences after the military. Certainly logistics, learning logistics, learning to work with others, etc. Excellent here. And other examples of dietitians making global contributions. I've told you about Alice. She is absolutely extraordinary. She is still pushing for more interaction. Ruth Dow, I guess Ruth is probably in her late 70s. She's volunteered with solar ovens and gardening in 22 Latin American countries. A younger dietitian, and Stacia may be here today. She's frequently at ADA. She has, in Malawi for 15 years, worked to improve nutrition through permaculture and is now working with the Ministry of Education related to school feeding. Stacia started with the Peace Corps in Malawi and then continued. She and her husband continued afterwards. Her husband happens to be a sociologist. Why do this? Remember that memories last a lifetime. My conclusions would be that there are many opportunities to participate in international activities, paid and volunteer. Many of you have knowledge, skills, and experiences that can be transferred to international settings. And finally, start today. Ask yourself, what will you do and how will you do it? Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bond, for more and very good advice, especially all of those questions and that framework, I think. So let's move on so we can have some interaction and discussion. I was thinking, harking back to, did I ever do anything? And I actually remember many years ago, but I was chicken. I was in a English-speaking country and volunteered to collect data on a diet assessment study. So I'm going to ask after our last speaker how many have already had experience, and then we'll get some questions and interaction. I'd like to introduce now Dr. Douglas Ballantyne. He is Director of Nutrition and Health for Unilever North America and a member of Unilever's Global Nutrition Leadership Team. He is responsible for nutrition communication, sciences, and health and wellness. Prior to that, he spent a number of years in the Netherlands and worked with their Food and Health Research Institute. He also led the global Unilever research program on the health benefits of tea. He has given talks all over the world, and one of the experts on the chemistry of tea, flavonoids, antioxidants, and health benefits of tea. Dr. Ballantyne received all of his degrees at Rutgers University in food science. He also had a postdoctoral fellowship at Rutgers where he conducted research on yeast cell biology and genetics. His studies combined the focus on nutritional biochemistry and food technology. He is a member of the American Dietetic Association, the Institute of Food Technologists, and the United States Tea Council. As an expert, his technical innovations have led to 8 U.S. patents. I welcome Dr. Ballantyne.
Yeah, good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. I was asked to speak to you this morning just from an industry perspective because, as you heard in the nice introduction I had, that through my career with Unilever, I've had the opportunity to work overseas and have some really unique experiences in doing that. So And as one of the nutrition leaders in Unilever, a global company, I can share with you a little bit about how Unilever views nutrition around the world and what some of the opportunities within a company like Unilever, but also I know Kraft and Nestle and Danone and many of the large multinational food players also have similar opportunities within their companies as I interact with many of their colleagues overseas as well. I don't have any formal slides this morning. They just asked me to kind of share a bit more informally about my experiences, so I'll kind of make a start. So when I, reflecting on what some of the talks we heard, when I started my career coming out of a nutrition and food technology background, I didn't really originally think about doing an overseas assignment, even though I was interacting with many colleagues within Unilever overseas. And, you know, at one point in time, they asked me if I'd be willing to take a position in the Netherlands and head up a food technology group there. And I gave it some thought, and I said that would really be an interesting opportunity, not only to see another part of the world, but to have a role that would be more global in nature rather than just focused on the U.S. And that was a really wonderful experience that I was able to have by taking on that role. And I'll just share a little bit about some of those experiences that I've had that will reflect on some of the comments that you've already heard. And then I'll come back to sharing some comments about the types of nutrition opportunities in Unilever in food companies and what you can expect to maybe do within those kind of roles and what maybe you won't be able to do in those kind of roles. So for me, when I landed overseas in the Netherlands, language was one of those things. The nice thing about Unilever is that pretty much everywhere in the Unilever world, everybody speaks English reasonably well, although not always the same English, which we find is interesting. And but yet, you know, if you're going to live in a country and you're going to interact with people locally and socially, you find that being able to at least understand their language so you can listen to traffic reports or talk to the local shopkeepers about what you want to buy in the local markets becomes kind of important. So one way or the other, whether or not you become fluent in it or not, you are going to need to be able to engage in the local language just to engage with the people locally. So I went through some crash courses in Dutch, and even though language isn't one of my best skills, I did manage to learn to speak Dutch and now can still understand Dutch even though I don't hear it every day. So it is one of those things that's important. But in my role in Unilever, I had a global technology role, so I was able to get involved with projects all over the world and travel to many, many countries all over the world where we were trying to develop new products and new business models to be able to get into those marketplaces. So one of the projects that we were working on is we were trying to develop a series of products, nutrition-based products for children in the developing and emerging markets. So our focus was in Africa, India, Turkey, and so we needed to go to those countries. So I remember one of the trips I made to Ghana. One of my colleagues there, we arrived there, and you know, the first night we're all just sitting around talking, and then he says, "Well, you know, tomorrow morning I'm just letting you know what you're going to do. I'm going to give you all a driver, and I'm going to give you a little bit of money, and he's going to take you first to the city market in Accra, the capital, where typical city people would go shopping, and your job is to see if you can buy all of your food and water, balance it nutritionally for €1 for the day." So that was the challenge. Could you do that with what was in the marketplace? And I'd never been to a marketplace in Ghana, so I had no idea what to expect. So I got into the local market, and it was like a big flea market. And I was surprised at the variety and types of foods that were available, but yet that was limited and well. And I found in the city market, in one day, you still couldn't buy it for €1 because even there, you could only buy, you still couldn't buy a small enough quantity of, let's say, rice or some lentils or beans, so you could buy more than you could use in a day. But in the end, you kind of figured out that, yeah, well, I could probably begin to buy things if I was really smart that I could make something reasonably nutritious at least out of the city markets. So then they, after we did that, the driver took me way out into the countryside into a village where one of the Unilever employees had grown up. You know, still a reasonably well-off village, but not particularly well-off, but representative of what typical Ghana people would live in. And so I got there, and you know, and they had a little house that I could stay at. That basically they had an air conditioner and a stove and a refrigerator and telephones and things, but none of it worked. So in the end, the only way to eat was the woman who was running the house just had to cook on a fire. And then you're like looking around and she's washing her her little son. And you could see her son had protein energy malnutrition. So you can see even though they were in this rural market and they were well off, these kids were on borderline in terms of nourishment. And then you went to the local school to talk to the school children, and they were all quite active and excited. I'm not sure they'd ever seen someone from the West before out in this part of Ghana, but we engaged quite well with them. But they still were looking for opportunities, and their opportunities were limited. And then they took me to talk to the local medical officer who ran the, this comes back to some of the experiences you might have heard about diabetes. And so I was asking the local medical officer about medicine and nutrition and health. And basically I quickly figured out that even though I'm not a medical doctor, from my nutrition training and just experiences in life, I knew a lot more about medicine and health and nutrition than their local medical doctor knew. So you even find there that there is a need in those rural areas for people that can just teach basic nutrition and health, basic hygiene, to help those people, and there is really a need. And then the next morning I had to go, the food that I'd bought at the city market was prepared into the evening meal, and that was a nice experience to get real local Ghanese food. And then the next morning I had to go to the rural market, and the rural market basically was very small little market with a couple of tables, almost no meat, except for a little bit of dried fish, very little produce, very little, only cassava. So when you started to look there in this local market on what those people could get, there's very little opportunity to really build a balanced meal, and it was extremely, the variety of things was extremely limited. So you could see that right there that helping those type of people in those villages with basic nutritious foods that were affordable for them was really, really critical. And so then we went back to say, how could we begin to develop products that might help these people? And that we could put into those markets that were within there, that they could afford to buy. And the reality is from a big multinational is that you also have to build the infrastructure to get ingredients and materials, because you can't import ingredients from the U.S. or Europe or other places into those countries and still sell it at a price that those people can afford to buy. So you need to be very, very strategic on how you begin to build the business models. So those are the types of experiences I had. Similar experiences in Latin America, in Thailand, in China. So when you begin to go around the world and have these immersions into what real people are and real cultures are like, it really does give you a really rich experience about how other people in the world live, how they shop, how they buy their foods, and the reality of their nutrition environment being completely different than the environment that we have in the United States. So it really is an enriching experience if you allow yourself to expose it to that sort of thing. And I was able through this job to also get involved with making products for a number of nutrition intervention trials that Unilever's run in those various markets to see whether or not we can improve nutrition status, improve cognitive function among young growing children in a number of those markets. So you can have some really interesting opportunities from a corporate point of view in going to a number of these markets. But what I would tell you is that, you know, big corporations like Unilever or multinationals, there's basically two types of jobs, and most of the jobs are jobs in the business side of the field, where really the objective is, can you run a business in those countries? Can you sell products at a profit? And it has to be reasonably profitable, because in our capitalistic world, Wall Street doesn't accept profit margins below a certain amount. And if you can't turn things on with profit margins above a certain expectation, you can never stay in business successfully in those marketplaces. So your reach down into the lower socioeconomic classes in those countries can only go so far down. So the poorest of the poor that are really malnourished and starving, well, we do things for them through donations and through charitable work that we might do as a company. And there are parts of the company that do that sort of work with NGOs. If you work for a big multinational, you're not going to be doing work on a general basis that's going to get to the poorest of the poor, where you're going to really be solving severe malnutrition. But you can do projects with people that are more kind of toward the middle class, where there's still significant micronutrient deficiencies. So, for example, in Ghana, when we first started to do business there, we found that most of the country was still significantly deficient in iodine. And there was significant cognitive impairment among school-age children in Ghana, because they simply didn't get the needed iodine in their diet. And when we looked at the marketplace, the one staple product that most Ghanis used every single day in their local cooking was salt. And while in our marketplace we have too much salt, it was the one vehicle where we could assure that we could get iodine into the diet and that children would get iodine on a daily basis. So we developed an iodine fortification project in packeted salt rather than just crude salt that they bought in the markets. And we were able to successfully do that in packets, get it distributed throughout the country economically, and with the help of the government and the local NGOs and the scientists. And it was quite successful in beginning to help bridge the iodine deficiencies in those countries, and it was successful in helping to improve cognitive development in many, many children in Ghana. So again, you can make a difference in those populations that are not severely starving or severely deficient, but are borderline in terms of nutritional sufficiency. So I'm just trying to keep you in mind of what you can expect you can do if you work for a big multinational and what you might not be able to do. And the realities of that. But there are a lot of very nice opportunities where you can begin to build nutrition-based products to put into those marketplaces that do make a real difference in people's lives around those countries. And so I was lucky to be able to experience a number of those in the work I've been able to do with Unilever and meet many colleagues and scientists around the world in doing that. I think within Unilever, I'll just switch to Unilever. Unilever, we employ about a little under 200 nutritionists around the world. Many of them are in Europe. However, we have quite a number in North America, a nice team of nutritionists in Latin America, in Africa, India, all around the world. We have nutritionists. Some of them are better trained than others, to be honest. Oftentimes we find it's difficult to get nutritionists that are as well trained as we might like them. So it is one of the jobs that we need to do with the RDs and nutritionists that we have that are well trained. Part of the role that they play in Unilever is to actually help train and help build the skills and competencies of the nutritionists we get in our local countries, and to teach them how to communicate, how to interact with scientists, and how they can begin to work with nutrition intervention programs in their country. So there's an opportunity for the more well-trained to go train those particular people. We also work in terms of giving opportunities for nutritionists to move around the world. So like I was able to move to the Netherlands, we've sent nutritionists that from Europe that go spend a year or 2 years working in Africa. We have nutritionists from Europe move to Latin America and do work in Brazil or in Chile or in Argentina for a number of years. We've got people from Argentina moving to Europe to take roles. I'm about to bring a lady from Kenya who's got her PhD out of a nice school in London to the U.S. to work on my team for 3 or 4 years. So there is really an opportunity when you work for a big multinational company to be able to move around the world if you're willing to travel. And being willing to get a little bit out of your comfort zone. And I think even with big companies now, you know, you can't expect, if you do those kind of traveling, there might be more of an opportunity if you're willing to say, there's a job in Unilever in Vietnam, for example, and I'd like to apply for that. And if you applied for that job directly in Vietnam and say, I'm not going to try to go get a job in a U.S. Unilever in America and then think I'm going to move to Vietnam, well, you might, but that's becoming much, much more difficult because the expense of doing that, of sending someone from the U.S. particularly into those markets on a temporary assignment is quite high. Whereas if you moved into those local markets and were willing to be paid a local salary, which in those particular countries, you can live reasonably well on their local salary because everything is cheaper, but the type of housing and everything is a bit different. So if you're willing to take some of the concerns we heard earlier about, do you feel safe? Are you willing to do different types of transportation? You can actually live in those marketplaces and live quite well. And I know a number of the nutritionists in those marketplaces that have grown up there in their lives have very nice lives. They have a very nice social environment, so you can do that. So there's two ways you can get those jobs. Either get a job in a big multinational like Unilever or Kraft in the U.S., and then look for opportunities from within that company to bridge to opportunities around the world, either short-term opportunities or long-term opportunities. So in Unilever, if we, in looking at an individual on my team that an experience on looking at communications program in India or Africa or Latin America would help build their experience and become a better nutritionist to bring back to using those skills in the U.S., we then would look at opportunities to send them over for 3, 6 months, even up to a year, to do a role in those countries. The other thing we try to do in Unilever is oftentimes, you know, a really good nutritionist in a certain country will be going on maternity leave, and maternity leave in many of those countries is up to a year. And we want to have their job ready for them when they come back from their maternity leave. So oftentimes, since all of the nutrition leaders around the world, we talk to each other and someone will say, yep, so-and-so is going on maternity leave next February, so there's an opportunity for someone to come to India for a year. So then we have discussions among our peers and say, you know, is there someone who that experience would benefit? And then we try to create that opportunity to send them into those opportunities in other places in the world. So that's a win-win. People get to experience other places in the world. They get to experience other cultures. They bring the skills and expertise that they've developed that they might have as RDs trained in the U.S. or nutritionists trained into the U.S. to those countries where they bring a different insight. They can help develop skills of those people, and then they also learn from the people in the local country environment and get to have a different experience. So I think there can be some really exciting opportunities to work internationally if you work for a large multinational company like Unilever, and like I said, like Kraft or others. You just need to be willing to travel. You need to be willing to be out of your comfort zone a little bit. You need to be willing to, I think some of the things you heard earlier about expecting what you're going to really be able to do and not being able to do, the type of work you might be able to do to help other people and what you may experience that you may not be able to help people that you think you'd like to help in the end, even though you've tried really hard. So oftentimes we have projects that we've run that despite the fact we've tried really hard and they make sense nutritionally in there, they're not successful in marketplace. And they don't end up being a successful business model, and we have lots of examples of those. So with that, I think I've kind of given you a little bit of my experience and from an industry point of view about the types of opportunities you might be able to get and in a company like Unilever overseas, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have when we have the question and answer period. So thank you.
Thank you all very much. I think I've been inspired, as many of you may have also. I think that we've covered, you know, some of the opportunities in nonprofits, profits, and so it really has been a unique opportunity to think about how we will all have some impact on world health and nutrition and the food aspect, of course, which is crucial. So I'd like to invite the other speakers back to have a panel discussion. How many of you in the audience have at some time gone over and volunteered, paid, worked in other countries, and how many? I'm sure lots. And those, almost everyone, and then there are all the others that are planning to go and planning to go soon. So I would like to, there are two microphones, so if people have questions or comments for the group, as you think about those, I will get started. And there were a number of themes I think you talked about, you know, working collaboratively in those countries, really looking at the interdisciplinary nature and the broadness. Nutrition is important, but it fits into all the other aspects of living in other areas. Now have people there, but what I was thinking about too is think about what was the most important, one of the most important contributions, you know, that you feel emotionally in the first time or at some point? I know you've all contributed in various countries, but what was most important? So, but I'll defer to first speaker.
Hi, thank you. That was
question.
That was really informative and very inspiring. I'm ready to go back overseas now. I'm currently working on a PhD at an American university, and I would like to broaden my research to include other countries. Can you please give me some advice on putting together an IRB? Should I go through an international university in order to do that, or is that something typically I could do out of my home university?
Okay. You mean to get approval for the research? With
exactly.
You? Okay. At our university, we would have to go, and everywhere we've worked that I know about and the grad students that I've had who've worked internationally, we must go through our university, but we also must go through whatever unit you're working with in the host country, and this may take some time. In fact, one of my students who did research in South Africa during the apartheid, actually, we had to go through the chiefs as well as the human use there. So you're going to, yes, you have to do it. It is absolutely essential. And within, in some countries, you may even have to do something with the government, not just with the university itself. Is that the right answer, Lorraine? Yes, Lorraine is working in South Africa, in Botswana and Tanzania. And so I'm sure that's it. And expect it to take longer than you think it will on campus as well as off campus. Double it or triple it, particularly if you're working with infants, for example.
And at my own university, you can quadruple it. It takes a long time.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
But it's so important. Any of you who want look at the current book about the HeLa cells, that's a bestseller right now, and you understand why it is so important that we have this clearance, this human use clearance.
Thanks.
Next question on the right. Right from here, left there.
Good morning. My name is Camille Brewer. I'm the Director of International Affairs at the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. I want to thank the speakers this morning. I'm very much encouraged to see such broad interest in working internationally. Not a question, but a comment. I would hope that we would include the federal government as we think broadly about our interests. My staff does global international food safety policy. We work with Codex Alimentarius. We work with the World Trade Organization. I was in Ethiopia 2 weeks ago for a Codex meeting for Africa. Tonight I'm flying to Bangkok for an FAO meeting on equivalence and comparability. So indeed, the opportunities, if you're brave, if you think non-traditionally, if you're open to different opportunities, the world literally is yours. So I would encourage you to think about federal government. The Food and Drug Administration has an international component. My deputies, a PhD, RD, we recently opened an office in Mexico. The associate director is an RD. So, again, I'm so pleased and so encouraged to see you all and just jump one out there. The world is yours. Thank you.
Thank you.
May I comment?
Sure.
I was concerned about my time limit. But I would really concur with what she has said. And USAID, at the present time, if you go to their website, they have a paid student intern program, and they also have a volunteer student intern program. You do have to be a U.S. citizen to apply for those. Those internships are in a variety of areas, but health is one of those areas. So that is one of the opportunities for you. I didn't include that, but that, I thought, followed the FDA.
Thank you. Next question.
Hi, I'm Diane Stadler. I'm from Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon, and have a question primarily for the third speaker first in asking whether or not Unilever or other companies actually have some type of paid internships for students to gain, you know, 3 to 6 months of experience internationally. And the reason I'm asking is because many of our students now are coming out of school with incredible debt, incredible student loans that have to start being paid within 3 to 6 months of graduating from their program and accepting a job. We also have a huge number of students who actually want to either volunteer or work in paid positions internationally, but can't because they know the responsibilities that they have. And I'm just wondering if there's any way that we can kind of pave a path that makes it more accessible and not necessarily limited to those individuals who can afford to hold a volunteer position for a period of time.
Good idea. Doug?
Sure. I know we are doing internship programs or summer programs in different places around the world. I know what we're doing in the U.S. because mm-hmm. that's a bit more structured. I'm less clear what we're doing in other places. I also know that one of the other things we're working through IUNS with a number of others to say how can we, with the companies, help to provide nutrition training and education to build the overall nutrition capability and capacity, particularly in the developing and emerging markets. And through some of those training programs and education programs, there is an opportunity for students to travel and get education and training through some of the IUNS work as well. But I think that's something that might be interesting to explore, whether or not that there's opportunities for that kind of training and development as well.
I know it'd be appreciated. So. Thank you. Over here.
Thank you. I'm Joanne Graham from the CSU Sacramento Dietetic Internship. And I wanted to thank you for the nod, the second speaker, for the UC Davis Program in International Nutrition. That is where I went to do my doctoral work. Now as director of the Dietetic Internship at Sacramento State, I'm really interested in finding out more on how I can incorporate. I think there was Iowa State had a community nutrition rotation in Ghana. I'm really interested in finding out how I can do that. Is it need to be frameworked within a graduate program, or is it independent as part of just the internship process itself?
Yes. We'll have the expert.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know about that, but yes, you have to go through Katie. So we're accredited through the Katie component. The rotation that we are doing is embedded within our internship program. So the interns will do 3/4 of their program in the U.S. and then 1/4 of it in Ghana or in another international opportunity. So does that answer it? But
yeah, so it's not with. It doesn't have to be part of a graduate program in addition.
No. Ours is we are running it through our study abroad program like you, you're a university,
right.
So we're running it through our university study abroad with very good success.
And the funding for that?
Funding for that.
Mm-hmm. okay, so is it students then have to pay additional for the international?
Right. Okay. It ends up being our students are considered full-time graduate students, so they are qualifying for whatever aid they qualify for.
So they are considered graduate students?
Yes.
Okay. So they're in a graduate program in addition, so they're getting a master's combined?
They're getting a master's certificate, a graduate certificate. So we can talk a little bit more if you'd
okay.
like.
Thank you.
Yeah, we do have that available.
Thank you.
May I also add something? If you don't have an international study abroad that has some link with health, nutrition, dietetics, you may be able to go to, your students may be able to just enroll for a study abroad in another place. That is an option we do have within our study abroad program at Michigan State. The option that some students can come from other universities and perhaps do just a summer study abroad, They're going to pay for it, but it's still an option, particularly for those of you who have a special interest in a topic. So that would be an option. You don't have to be enrolled in any specific program.
Thank you. Over here? Yes.
Hi. My name is Peg Gregson, and I have an NGO. I'm a nutritionist. So if anyone would like to work in Central America or Haiti, you can email me. And we do collaborate with Tufts University, UNC Chapel Hill, and other universities following the ADA guidelines. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to get that out there. And then just to piggyback on Diane Stettler's comment and these others, my students that approach me usually panic and they want to know where they can get their funding. So just very briefly, I think there's room to do more fundraising here in AODA when Monique speaks. And then also from our panel, if they could offer us some resources where we can direct the students to go look. I mean, I have lots of ideas that I give my students, so I always tell my students in closing, not having funding is not an excuse to not go overseas. You need to know how to be creative and where to look for it. But maybe our panel has some ideas. I know somebody mentioned it in their PowerPoint. But other ways students can find funding.
Yes.
Okay. That's a tough one because there's so much, so many people looking for it now and so different from place to place. Students are really good, particularly at using the web, to start to find funding. There are some foundations. Work with your internet, if you have an international studies program there. If you have a local NGO, or someone you know who has supported similar projects, don't hesitate to look at those. And I would too agree. I would like to see an endowment in ADA that would support scholarship short term things like this.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Monique Richard.
Excuse me, I'm just going to compliment that.
Okay, just one moment.
So in my slides, I made reference to the CGIAR Global mm-hmm. Gender and Diversity Program, mm-hmm. which is a website that lists all sorts of scholarships, fellowship opportunities. So that would be one place to send someone to try to look for funding. I'm familiar with different universities that offer funding for students who are students there and wanted to have an international experience. Cornell University has a global health program at the undergraduate level, which encourages students to go abroad for a summer. Emory University in their public health program, if you are a student in their global health program, they have funding available for you to go overseas to get an overseas experience. Yale University and their public health program also offers funding for students to go overseas, and I'm sure that other universities do the same, so certainly tap locally within the university setting. And the other, in terms of being creative, I remember a friend of mine who was going to do her research work in Bangladesh, and she found through the internet that there was a Bangladesh association in the U.S. She wrote to them, and they underwrote her funding for her PhD work. So be creative, definitely.
Sorry.
It's okay. I'm Monique Richard. I am the Student Outreach Group Chair for the American Overseas Dietetic Association. So I just wanted to invite you all to take a look at eatrightoverseas.org. It's another great resource. We're an affiliate of ADA. We have 40 country representatives all over the world working with students, RDs, different projects, networks, NGOs. So I will be speaking more about studying abroad for, and it's not just for students. So if you want to be a member or a supporter, check out the website. And I'll be speaking today at the student forum at 1:30. So I just wanted to invite you guys that that's another great resource out there.
Thank you very much. Diane?
Yeah, I just wanted to make one more comment about funding. For people that are affiliated with a university or an academic center, one option is to talk to people in your development office and, you know, request funds and have them seek out donors who might be interested in providing a source of money for nutrition and dietetic students to go overseas. I know at our university, there's a lot of money for medical students to go overseas.
Yes.
but they won't use that money to support nutrition students to go overseas. So one of the things that I'm starting to do is work within our development office to see if there are donors available through our university or alumni who might be interested in providing $10,000 a year to send five or six students for a period of time into an international experience. It doesn't take a lot of money, but it's not money that students should have to pay. And, you know, that's essentially what we're doing. By them paying tuition, that's how they're funding their overseas work. And that limits the number of people that can do this. So I really think that we need to have strong support, either through ADA or through donation, or, you know, through strong resources with people that are committed to making that type of donation to a university and really taking advantage of people's willingness to want to help. So a development office is also a really strong opportunity for us to explore.
Helena?
Just as a follow-up, often the most expensive part of the experience is the airline ticket. Yes. So if you can get families or friends who are frequent travelers to give you their frequent flyer miles, that'd be one way to reduce that expense. Because as Doug mentioned, living overseas can be really cheap. When I lived in Nicaragua in 1996, I was living on $150 a month in the capital. So you can do it.
Yes, another question.
Hello, my name is Larissa Laufman, and I'm an MPH and a student and a dietetic intern at the University of Texas School of Public Health in Houston. And I'm actually finishing up the Master's of Public Health program right now, and I'm trying to decide on my next step, and I'm considering getting a PhD, but I really want to go abroad and get more experience that way. So I wondered if you could give me any advice on how I should proceed with that. So.
You mean go abroad first and then get the PhD, or get the PhD and go?
Sure, or if it really is needed to get the PhD, if that's really an important key in doing that, because I know that's another avenue where I can, usually there's a program that I could find that I could go abroad through that program as well.
Thank you. I appreciate all the questions, and I'm going to ask the panel to answer your question and also give any last comments or last words. Thank you. Jenny, you want to start?
Well, I know I wouldn't trade anything for the 3 years I worked between my undergraduate degree and my graduate degree, because it really helped me focus on what my interests were. And then there's no substitute for getting your feet wet in some of those. I would suggest you try to do something. If you're really interested in international long term, have you had any experience prior to this?
Yes, I actually studied abroad in France and Switzerland.
So. Well, France and Switzerland, and that's the other thing. When you do a study abroad, most of our students, our largest enrollment is London. Now, London is not the study abroad's there. Look carefully at those study abroads. If you're really interested in international, look at something in a developing country, if that's where you want to be in the end. And so I would suggest that let's say it this way. If I were in your shoes and I could afford to take the time, and in the end the time is very small in terms of your lifetime, hopefully, I would get my feet wet in some international experience, be that something with an NGO, a church group, whatever, because I think it will very much temper how you approach your PhD.
Okay.
Now
yeah.
That comes, as my husband said, when he said, why are they inviting you for this? He said, it must be because you're one of the elder states people. And I thought that was a compliment. But that comes from experience. There's just nothing like you would agree. You can study it in the books, but when you're down in the field itself, and you're holding a baby who is near death because of starvation, it really affects you the rest of your life.
Yeah, the study abroad program I was in actually was focused on public health and global health
And so we got to visit a lot of national and international NGOs.
Good. Good.
So.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Helena, last words.
Lauren, I would encourage you to consider Peace Corps.
Yes.
One of my colleagues said that it was the best two-year investment he ever made, and a lot of the friends who helped me put together the presentation said people who come with Peace Corps just have a very different world. Just their world, their view completely changes. So if that's something that's possible, I would encourage you to do that, to think about Peace Corps. And if you don't need to have an international experience necessarily to get into a PhD program where your focus will then be international, you have to look at different programs. In nutrition, for example, there's on the East Coast, there's Harvard, there's Hopkins, there's Cornell, there's Columbia, there's Emory, UNC Chapel Hill. West Coast, we've got at least UC Davis. I mean, there are just tons of opportunities out there, and often they will have a requirement of how many years of any experience you need to have, but not necessarily international. And then you can get that international experience through your PhD. So good luck, Lauren.
Okay, thank you.
Doug, last words?
Yeah, I think they gave you good advice. Getting experience is really important. So if you can't get into a PhD program that's truly international, and another one you might consider is Tufts University. I'm on the I'm friends of Tufts Foundation, and I do a lot of work with Tufts, and they've got an international nutrition division, and so that there could be a very good opportunity. And I've heard some of their students talk about projects that they've run in many, many developed countries that are really absolutely amazing what they've been able to do as a PhD student. So if you can get into one of those programs and get both the international experience while you're getting your PhD, that would be a win-win. But if that's not going to be a reality, then I think their advice of getting some experience now where you really get a different exposure really kind of gives you a much broader view of the world and what kind of nutrition opportunities might be, and then that also might completely shift what type of PhD work you might really want to do when you come back. So I think it's a bit of trying to balance both.
One more.
I would just really agree with that, particularly with the Peace Corps. I gave you Stacia as an example. She and her husband went as Peace Corps volunteers in Malawi, and they're still there 17 years later. And the other thing is that many of the people with whom I have worked internationally start with the Peace Corps. USAID and others start with the Peace Corps.
Okay, I want to thank all of you. I want to thank Alice. I want to thank our inspiring speakers, and you've been a wonderful audience. So enjoy the rest of the meeting.